All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of Liberty Lens, your libertarian show that focuses, focus on one issue every week. My co-host rolling his eyes at my hack-like humor is none other than Mike Termont. Mike, how are you doing this week?
In focus with you, John. It's good to be together.
It's good that we can align on my horrible sense of humor and childlike use of metaphors. But that aside, something not childlike and something that does require a lot of thought this week on Liberty Lens is the budget. As libertarians, dare I say, as Americans, perhaps our biggest concern should be how much of our money is government planning on spending? Now, Mike, I hear tell that a government run by and controlled by Republicans should be producing a budget that is not as crazy about spending as it has been under the Democrats. Is that the case?
Well, not much. You're right that, you know, this is an adult topic, whether it's right. Childlike or not, maybe actually dubious. The Senate has a budget resolution now. The House does as of this morning. And what is clear is that the Republican Party on both the House side and the Senate side are perfectly comfortable with spending more money, taxing you more, spending more money even to the point of having greater deficits than ever before, and for those to increase over the next decade, for the amount of debt that the federal government has borrowed, for that to increase over the decade, even relative to the size of our economy, relative to the size of our nation. And so if you believe, as I do, and I think a lot of folks do, you don't have to be a libertarian to believe what right. I'm about to say, which is that we have a debt problem, not just too much, but unsustainably too much.
Right.
That we have an amount of debt which will continue to increase unless we do some things fundamentally differently until the federal government runs into a problem being able to service that debt, and that could lead to a financial collapse of the federal government and therefore a collapse of our economy.
You know, Mike, before we get into the numbers and being a good Austrian economist, we have a table ready to go. So you let me know when you want me to pop that up. But let me start off with a general question. And I'm phrasing it sarcastically, but I think a lot of people actually do have this notion, and I want you to address it. What's wrong with debt? Our president has made a fortune manipulating debt. As a smart businessman, Trump has essentially considered debt to be just another financial tool, right? Famously, he lost a lot more than he's ever been worth. He once famously said, "I don't care about debt as president because I can always just print out more hundreds to cover the debt." Or, "It's money we owe to ourselves, and I can forgive money I owe to myself." And you get a lot of these modern monetary theories, you get a lot of these sort of weird mixtures of Keynesianism and MMT or whatever. So maybe briefly explain to people, why is debt bad?
Sure. First of all, modern monetary theory is not modern. It's just this kooky idea that debt doesn't matter and you should right. pay no attention to it. So if anyone even brings it up, best roll your eyes, get a soda pop, and change the channel.
Gotcha.
Debt matters because it is owed, and it is owed to real people like you and me and millions of other people. And we are also on the hook for it. There is a difference, of course, between the people who owe it are going to end up paying the taxes to right. pay it. Our federal government owes it, and the people to whom it is owed, although there are many people who are in both of those pools, right?
Right.
Plenty of us are taxpayers who hold Treasury securities in our portfolios. But what's really important is that the federal government's currency, fiat currency, about which we're all upset,
right.
but the government's fiat currency is so strong because our economy is strong and because the financial position of our government is strong and trustworthy. And if our government faces a financial collapse, if it is unable to meet its obligations at some point, the bond market would absolutely collapse. Treasury right. securities are the bedrock on which the rest of the securities markets in the United States and around the world, parenthetically, right. are built. And if those markets collapse, currency markets would collapse, the U.S. dollar would collapse, and let's be honest, the U.S. dollar is the only reserve currency in the world worth a damn. Right. And so it would cause us an immediate and deep depression that would be very difficult to get out of without an effectively operational currency. As much as we would love a competitive market for currencies and for something to challenge the dollar, whether that's Bitcoin or anything else, I would love to see something in second place that would rival the dollar, not only to make the dollar stronger from the competition,
right.
but to step in if the dollar should ever collapse. And we just don't have anything in a near second place right now. So it's really important for our government to not just fall apart. You cannot just walk away from $36 trillion of obligation and think that the people that are owed that $36 trillion are going to be okay with it, because they're not.
So, and again, I'm not necessarily focusing this on Trump, but when Trump says literally he doesn't care about the debt, really, he doesn't care about it.
He's being silly.
He's being silly. But the thing that you mentioned that I've always said all along is you don't want the dollar to be removed from its status as a reserve, the reserve currency for the world.
The only one worth a damn in the whole world.
Right. It used to be, say, the pound sterling, right, say 150, 200 years ago, because it was the stability of the British Empire that people felt like, hey, this fiat will be good no matter what happens.
It was a hell of a currency through World War One.
I would agree with you. And I would say when I entered the currency markets as a young lad in the 90s, prior to the euro, sterling, to your point, was number two behind the dollar, yeah. pound sterling, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's gone now, replaced by the euro. So I think most people—
and the euro is a distant second.
Yeah, it's hot garbage. But the point is that I think a lot of people, when they talk about debt and they talk about let's slash this and let's slash that, while good, or in the opposite case, while people say, I don't care about the debt. As long as, you know, we got those printing presses going, they don't take that into account. The fact that the rest of the world, all of commerce, all of trade, relies on the dollar and the ability of the U.S. government to meet its obligations.
Defaulting. And you don't create value by printing money. Everyone in your audience knows that. And
yeah.
so printing money just creates inflation and worse, arguably, the expectation of more inflation in the future, which is devaluing every dollar that you print and every dollar that right. you ever did print, and will eventually undermine your economy altogether and undermine, therefore, your ability to service that debt. So there is no way out other than reducing that debt, at the very least, relative to the size of the economy.
Right.
I believe that we need to reduce the amount of debt, full stop, period. But at the very least, as a proportion of our economy, we need to decrease it.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me. All right, do you want me to bring up the budget resolution?
Sure, what the heck? Let's get into some numbers. I think people, you don't have to be a power nerd to enjoy this table. And a good-looking table it is.
I agree.
Look, as a little bit of quick background, the Senate did enact its – enact is the wrong word. It did resolve – its budget goals last week, and these numbers are from that Senate budget resolution. The House of Representatives finally came to a budget resolution this morning. The two have to come to some agreement. They will go into conference and negotiate the differences between the two, which are not huge right now. As much as anything, they're procedural differences that they need to right. negotiate their way through. They will come to an agreement, And then the House and the Senate need to both pass over again a budget resolution that is common to the two of them. And then the individual committees in the House and the Senate can get to work at coming up with the detail to flesh out what is this resolution, which is merely the structural bones of what a budget would be. And assuming they get all the way through that, they will have to, and that we call the reconciliation process. Once they get through all that, they have to come to an agreement again. They have to pass a common budget, the two of them, and then that goes to the White House for President Trump to sign. And presumably he will, because his influence is going to be heavy throughout this process. So it's really the White House, the Senate, and the House negotiating their way through it, and hopefully it'll be a relatively smooth process. It will leave Democrats out, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it. To your earlier point, I'm not sure there's a huge enough difference between Republicans and Democrats these days to get all torn up about certain subgroups being left out of the process.
Yeah, and when I look at these numbers, being a little bit of a nerd myself when it comes to numbers, Mike, we can see that the deficit they're proposing between 2025, fiscal 2025, fiscal 2034, so they're giving themselves 10 years, right, on this sort of thing.
It's a 10-year, it's typically a 10-year program, yep.
Yeah, the deficit actually increases, so they're not saving money at the end of 10 years.
Yep.
And the debt, separate from the deficit, is growing from $36 trillion to $49
trillion. It's a big difference.
It's a huge difference. It's not fixing anything. And to let folks know who are cheering on Doge, cheering on Elon Musk, Mike, while we agree in principle with him, we could see that the savings he's identified or that Doge has identified – wouldn't even begin to make a dent.
No,
right?
He's finding billions, and good for him, right?
Yes, yeah.
Even when even if you fix a problem that's only $1 million, you know, good for him.
Right.
But we're talking about dozens of billions, and to make a difference, you need hundreds of billions, and even trillions to make a difference over a 10-year period. So what Doge is doing is really as a matter of principle, as you just said.
Yeah, and again, to let people know, in this process, the reconciliation process, Mike, you know, before we even get to that, I think we kind of see where this is headed, because the people in charge, the Republicans, the conservatives, the whoever you want to call them, the Trumpites, the MAGAs, the MAHAs, only one person in the House voted against it.
Thomas Massie voted against it in the House. Rand Paul voted against it in the Senate. These are guys that are, I think for the most part, you would consider them libertarians. They're in the Republican Party. They're not in the Libertarian Party, of course. I saw Massie on television yesterday saying, why would I vote for this? It has more spending, more debt. How the savings are going to come in the future. And to be fair, each of the resolutions does say that there will be spending cuts, but the spending cuts are not enough to offset the natural growth in these programs, particularly in entitlements that have a mind of their own. They grow on their own. That's why they're called entitlements, because it doesn't take the Senate and the House and the White House to agree to pay these amounts of money from one year to the next. People are entitled, courts have said, people are entitled to these payments. And so unless laws are enacted to step down the obligations of the federal government, these entitlements are going to continue to grow. So even though there are cuts, we're going to put that graph back up in a minute, but even though there are cuts proposed, yet to be articulated, yet to be fleshed out, yet to be specified, they are not enough. We already know they are not enough to offset the growth rates in entitlements and in other programs. So we're headed to a very bad place. Good for Massey for pointing it out.
Good for Massey for pointing it out, but already feeling the wrath of his own party. When you see the reactions, it's stunning to me that we're not even past the first 100 days of the new Trump/MAGA administration. And the one guy who says, hey, the thing we ran on, we're not delivering. We're not even close to delivering. And, Mike, I think this is where I see hypocrisy is an overused term, so I don't know if I want to use it, or say cognitive dissonance in this case, right?
At least frustration.
We're cheering on $50 million savings in condoms not going to some third world country, allegedly. Okay.
Assuming that story is true, yeah.
Assuming it's true. And we could all laugh at it and say, yeah, good job. Stop that. It's a waste of money. But then when you look at it big picture-wise, as we've always said, cutting out all of USAID doesn't amount – it's not even a rounding error in this thing.
No, 1,000 times more than that problem would be $50 billion.
Yeah.
And our problem is 50 trillion.
So right.
It's a million times bigger than a $50 million problem. It's
right.
Huge. And I do believe that, you know, we used to, when I worked for the White House Office of Management and Budget in the 14th century, the Senate used to call Social Security the third rail, right?
Right.
Speaking of your use of metaphors, alluding to the fact that if you were to grab the third rail of an electronified train, it would kill you. These days, I think a lot of politicians agree with that, and it's too bad, but entitlements are most of the spending of the United States federal government.
Right.
They are the driver of the growth. They are the reason why the federal government is going to go bankrupt. And so you're going to have to decide. Either you're going to take this bull by the horns and you're going to straighten things out, or notwithstanding, you know, political advice that says that you can't touch it, or the federal government of the United States is going to go bankrupt. And bankrupt is the wrong term, but it will reach a financial collapse.
Yeah.
There is no third possibility. Either we're going to straighten this out, beginning with entitlements, or the federal government of the United States is going to collapse by the middle of the century, full stop.
And, Mike, I've always said this. I know we've mentioned it before. It seems to me that something that could be accomplished and still be within the realm of political willpower is to simply freeze all levels of spending. You don't have to even take an axe to it. If you gave yourself a 10, 12, 15-year horizon and said, starting today, we're just not going to increase spending, period. Not these fake going from 10% increase to 5% increase counts as a 50% reduction in spending. We're not talking about double speak like that. We're like literally saying a hard monetary freeze on spending. We'd have a surplus at the end of that period, 10, 12
Absolutely
years at this point.
Absolutely, you would. However, to do that would require legislation that says we're going to, you know, freeze spending.
Right.
And everyone would know when you're voting on that, all your constituents would know that that is going to necessarily cut entitlement checks. Reduce, haircut entitlement checks, whether it's Social Security or Medicaid, Medicare payments to facilities and providers,
sure,
welfare payments,
food
stamp, whatever. It's necessarily going to haircut all of that, and that's where the political pushback is going to come.
But isn't that a more likely?
Absolutely. I've always thought that the only politically viable way to do this is an overall freeze, that you can't just go after it program by program by program, because there'll be too much wailing and gnashing of teeth. I do like the resolution and then reconciliation process, it is easier for the Senate and the House to pass these resolutions. In this case, you know, they're talking about $10 trillion of cuts. Good for them, but it's nowhere near the amount of cut that they need to get to. But it's easier for them to do that than to specify, right? The next few weeks, they're going to have to specify where that $10 trillion of savings is going to come from. And that's going to be very, very contentious.
Right.
So I do believe that we need to find a way to pass a resolution and then have some automated, maybe the wrong word, but some sequester mechanism.
Right.
Which is the budget term of art, that in effect impounds funds by haircutting everything across the board. Everyone's got to take a haircut so that it's not so politically painful in any one program.
And Mike, I mean, I think I've heard you advocate this before, even when you were on the campaign trail, a rules-based sort of budget, right? Where you say, like, okay, if we don't want to have a hard freeze, you want to start reducing it according to some formula, but that formula is not mutable, right? Like, people can't politicize their way out of it because you know what the formula is and you know what you have to do. Now, by the way, what I've always said is by freezing it, that doesn't mean you can't reallocate stuff under that hard cap.
That's right. You can have whatever fight you want, but in the absence of coming to an agreement, some automatic haircut would take place. So you have this, you know, sword of Damocles hanging over your head to keep you motivated to come up with some negotiated solution. But if you don't, the haircut comes nonetheless.
How much do continuing resolutions work against the Americans, Mike, American citizens, Mike, in resolving this? The continuing resolution is really like giving a heroin addict, I don't know, getting them hooked on cocaine.
Absolutely. It just keeps the ball rolling. It gets people out of having to conduct these tough negotiations. It gets them out of having to figure out what cuts to make. It keeps the government open. Much better would be to have the pressure of the government closing and the political damage that it does to these idiots so that they would have pressure to make the hard choices.
Do you ever see any sort of way that continuing resolutions will be booted from the legislative toolkit?
No, I don't. The only I continue to believe that, just like you were saying earlier, the only way to go at this is an umbrella agreement, that everything is going to get cut by some common percentage if we don't come to a more refined, more articulated, longer-term negotiated solution and force the politicians to live with that if they can't get along and come up with something smarter. So let's show your audience. Throw the chart back up there for a moment.
Sure.
You see entitlements at the top. Look at fiscal 2025, which, by the way, is the year that begins October 1st of calendar 2025. So it's next year. Entitlements at $4 trillion. That's 4 out of $7 trillion. The total budget is about $7 trillion. And you'll see it's made up of $4 trillion of entitlements, less than $1 trillion of defense, another $1 trillion just in paying interest on the debt. That's painful. And then another $1 trillion, too, 1.2. Everything else added up. Think about that. And that comes to about 7.1, and then they say they're going to get $1 trillion, $1.0 trillion of savings that they haven't figured out yet, to bring it down to 6.1. And they're talking about revenue of 5.2, mostly income tax, but other things too. So they're proposing that the deficit will be about 0.9 trillion, expanding to 1.7 trillion over the 10-year period. All that is assuming that the Trump previous era, 2017 tax cuts, do get extended. I think most people expect that that will be the case. And that's including an extra $300 billion over 10 years for the border and
yeah.
to expand the Navy. And that's what the little note there says. Not a huge amount of money per year, but that's something that they're already agreeing to.
And Mike, what's interesting, forgive my old man math here, but my quick for fiscal 25 is, what am I looking at? Roughly 86% goes to entitlements, defense, and interest.
Yeah.
Literally 14%, about a seventh, right? So about 14% covers everything else the government
everything
does.
Else.
Right?
So, you know, negotiate all you want on that. You're not making headway unless you make a significant change to defense. I do believe that we can save serious amounts in defense by being smarter. We're talking about increasing from something like 290 ships today. 296 is the working number. In the long run, to 360, people are talking about 370 ships. This is a very expensive way to project power. And, of course, projecting power is a very expensive way to conduct foreign policy. I believe that we can save money there. But even if you did, you wouldn't save enough money to resolve your problem, which is largely in entitlements. And you see entitlements expanding there from $4 trillion to $6 trillion, not because we expect there to be so many more poor people in the United States, but we do expect there to be many more old people in the United States, including you and me. By 2034, I do believe that you and I should be pulling out a great deal more money than we're putting in to the Social Security Fund.
Sure.
And it won't be just you and me. It'll be several million, dozens of millions of our closest friends. And that is the problem. You need to haircut that. You need to start paying people at a later time than 65, right? That's a number that was set up a long, long time ago when people were retiring and then only living a little while before passing away. That's not the way demographics work anymore.
The life expectancy when FDR passed it as part of his New Deal, the first retired 65, the life expectancy of women, which was the longer of the two, was 66. So the expectation on average was that you would be on Social Security for a year after you retired, literally.
And think about how many different things are piled into that. First of all, you didn't have so many women in the workforce. So now not only do you have more women in the workforce, meaning people pulling out a lot of money out of Social Security for a longer period of time, but even the men's life expectancy has gone up by at least another decade. And so instead of, you know, this isn't 80 years versus 70 years. Oh, it's a little bit longer. No, to your point, right? It's going from an expectancy of a couple of years of retirement to going to an expectation of a couple of decades of retirement.
Right.
So it's really exploded by like a factor of 10. And this is why the entitlement obligation has expanded.
Yeah, and I agree with you because you and I have looked at numbers all our lives, and I think we instinctively know what's going to make a dent, what's not going to make a dent. And that, I don't know, I'm not speaking for you, Mike. This is Big John's opinion here. That's why I think DOGE in some ways is doing a disservice. Follow me here. It's not a disservice in what they're identifying because, yes, waste exists. You and I can hold hands and sing about this all day long. The more you cut, the better off you are. And government is largely inefficient and useless at accomplishing any task. So we're all aligned with DOGE on that. But I think it's fooling people into thinking that once Elon cuts all those gall darn Democrats and libtards from the government, the perverts and whatever else they're finding, right, that it's kumbaya, will be great. And the truth of the matter is that's that part of that other. That's part of that 14% that's other. The 86% will just continue to grow and grow and make things worse.
Absolutely. And the way I see it, John, is that the way Doge has gone could be, probably still could be, a great thing, even in this context, if it were used the way that I had suggested in the beginning that I thought it should be used, which is to build up political capital. In right. other words, you can't go into this thinking you're going to solve the federal government's financial problem by identifying waste, fraud, and abuse. That's just not, it is not enough money there.
Right.
But if you decided this is how we're going to build up political capital, this is how we're going to get the American people on our side, right? By demonstrating we're willing to work hard at it.
Right.
And by demonstrating there is a lot of stuff, crap out there that needs to be fixed. If you had made that case, right, it's a communications project, not a financial project. And then got Democrats involved. You know, right. the Democrats are up against the rope. They're reacting in very bad ways, and they're being silly. 4 times out of 5, in my view, in how they react to these things. Whereas, if you had given them an on-ramp to join you, right?
Right.
What silliness do you hate? I mean, everyone's got, you know,
right.
some favorite thing that they think that ought to be fixed. And used this communications project to steamroller anyone who stood up and said, oh, I think the federal government is just fine the way it is, right? Which is what some Democrats are effectively positioning themselves as,
right.
which is
totally amazingly.
Ridiculous.
Right, amazingly, yes, I agree.
If you had used this to build up political capital and then said, okay, now let's talk about what's really important. This is how we're going to spend that political capital. Now that you understand what we understand, which is we're all willing to work hard at this. We've got a huge problem. Here's our financial problem. Our financial yeah. problem is we have too much debt. That debt is not going to resolve on its own. We're going to have to start paying some of this back, and that means tightening our belt as far as spending. If you have that conversation with Democrats and the American people, you've got a shot, right?
Right, right.
You've got a shot. If you piss everybody off and make us look like, you know, just a bull in a china shop for no other reason than to piss people off, it's going to be very difficult to make the lift that you are identifying, right? This lift is much bigger, and it's going to take a lot of political capital to achieve that.
Yeah. I agree with you. They should have been more Machiavellian about it. Instead of, you know, there's times for a gentle touch. There's other times to take out the hammer, you know, and it's in this particular case, basically saying, if you don't agree with us, we're going to primary you, which is sort of this bull in a china shop approach that you've mentioned. Work a little bit at it.
The other thing that I would have done is I would have included Democrats and Doge.
Yes, but then that eats away at a different political base, and that's where the politics comes in, right?
Of course it does, yeah. But now is the time you're going to need some of that. Let's put it this way. There is no way you're going to get the American public to swallow entitlement cuts unless you've got a handful of Democrats saying, you know, I guess we got to do what we got to do.
Right, right.
You know, you're not going to get Bernie Sanders to be enthusiastic. That's not what I'm talking about. But
right.
you need a handful of Democrats to say, oh, I guess the time has come to do the patriotic thing and all time. Man, these people have made the case. I've been involved in Doge myself. I've seen what's going on. The numbers make sense. And you know, you carry a dozen. That's all we're talking about. 10. You could probably do it with 8 because you got to get to 60. You got to get to 60 senators. You need a few, and you need a few
right.
Democratic representatives to say it's the right thing to do. And you're not getting there if, you know, we're having these silly fights about $50 million here and there.
Right. Okay. Mike, I want to wrap this up on one question because I think it's important and kind of, okay. they put a budget together. Let's say they did the right thing. They plan it out for 12 years. They freeze spending. They start doing the sequesters, formulate everything you and I would be very happy to see happen. Let's face it, it could all be undone by the next Congress.
Yep.
Do we need a constitutional amendment, in your opinion, assuming we could wave a magic wand? Because those things may take up to 50, 60 years to ratify, right, a constitutional yep. amendment. But is that the level of seriousness we need where lawmakers can fall back on the excuse, look, it's a constitutional requirement,
yes.
we have to balance the budget or whatever?
Yes, you asked the question in two slightly different ways, so you're going to get two answers. The
Fair
second
enough.
Half was, is it that level of seriousness? Absolutely it is. It is that level. It's an existential threat to the government. And as much as I hate the government, it's not going to go quietly.
Right.
And bringing it down in a disorderly fashion is not good for our economy. And so it is an existential threat to our economy. It is that level of seriousness. I think that we have two bites of the apple, and I don't know whether either would work, let alone both. One is the constitutional amendment, and one is a White House, maybe this one, but a White House building up enough political capital, having control of both the House and the Senate, as the Republican Party does now. So a lot of stars are aligning.
Right.
A relatively libertarian-minded president. One might argue round or square whether Donald Trump is that, but he could be. And building up the political capital necessary to make the changes to the budget that you and I are talking about and making it stick.
Mm.
And I think for that to work, it'd be very difficult not to do in the first year of a four-year presidency. And it would be very difficult for it to stick if you did it later on in a presidency, right? You've got to do it early and then give people 2 or 3 years to realize
right.
the roof isn't caving in.
Right.
It might be tough, but the roof isn't. You might be voted out of office, but the economy is not going to collapse, and perhaps it would stick. It reminds me of Obamacare. When it was leaked,
right.
the big argument was, well, you know, we'll enact it and the American people will learn to love it. Well, that's evil shit.
Yeah.
Right? That is evil shit. But when you are saving the balance sheet of the federal government that sits on top of 25% of the planet's GDP.
Right.
This is important, and you need people to get a chance to realize that the economy will do fine, better in the long run, right? But even in the short run, the economy would survive it, and the White House that enacts it, sure, might get voted out, but if you did it in the first, maybe second year of an administration, maybe there's enough momentum that thing sticks. We can hope.
You could have a runway of sorts, and people could get used to it, like you said. Once they see, I think people would be very amenable to that if they got the sense that it was dispassionate and across the board. I think once you take away the, like, well, why am I getting cut for my interests but not so-and-so? Why is so-and-so's interests being protected? Why are the elites somehow protected but not
That's
the
That's a really good point, which is why the umbrella mechanism is so much more appealing, because the rhetoric that comes with it is, well, everyone's going to, you know, take it in the shorts a little bit. The only other alternative, John, is for us to get closer to a disaster and everyone is just up against a wall. The problem with that is bad decisions get made in such situations.
Sure.
And as you know from the world of finance, you typically don't know when you're close to things stink, they stink, they stink, they stink, they stink, and all of a sudden it's too late. So I worry about waiting until our backs are up against a wall.
Yeah, I don't know why you mentioned that, and the movie The Big Short just popped into my head, but there it goes. That's the perfect example, right, of
That is exactly right.
We know it's bad. Oh, crap. The bottom just fell out. And because of that,
fast enough.
Yeah, and now we got even more crap building up, right?
It reminds me of the real estate crisis in 2007 and, you know, credit card debt, lots of mortgage debt and credit card debt exploding. I remember in 2005 listening to economists saying, these bank portfolios, we don't know how they will perform. If we get the slightest downturn in the economy, it could be very, very bad for banks, which would be very, very bad for lending, which would be very, very bad for real estate, and it could be a major catastrophe. And I remember thinking over the next year and a half or so, man, you know, we probably got to make some serious change. I personally didn't make the changes for myself,
right,
that I knew I had to make. I waited too long and had to ride out, you know, that financial collapse in a way that I wish I hadn't.
Right.
I survived, but it was nasty. It was grueling. In other words, even when you know the disaster is coming,
It's difficult.
You don't know when, and the changes you need to make are unpleasant.
You're right. And for a lot of people, even the liberals who might occasionally fall across this show, a lot of that was precipitated by what was initially intended by, let's face it, liberals to be a good thing, which was the CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act.
It triggered
a lot of this, right?
The CRA, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac with a mandate to increase home ownership, more liberal lending in cards and personal loans, and especially mortgages. Absolutely. We could argue that that was all well-intended, but
absolutely,
as libertarians, we recognize that this sort of policy had no business imposing itself from the federal government on private sector financial institutions.
Agreed 100%. And Mike, I think that might be a good note to end on, but let's do this instead. You have been watching Liberty Lens with my good friend and co-host Mike Termont. I'm Big John right here on Grumblings Media. Catch us again next Thursday when the new episode will drop. Until then, peace, everyone.